through and try to hash out the details, and then tell everyone else they didn't know anything until they were brought out of stasis, which is more or less the truth. "So what's next for us?" Twinko asked. Doc cut Jason off before he could even open his mouth fully to speak. "There's still one more thing we should do before we call this done," Doc said quickly. "Bondurus wasn't just into abduction and trafficking. Part of what I did for him involved some pretty heavy and illegal genetic engineering. He has a vast, automated facility into which he's invested a substantial part of his fortune. Taking it out would break him."
"Doc," Jason spoke up first, "freeing the people in the vault was a righteous move, and it was in parallel with our need to escape ourselves. But this seems to be nothing but revenge, which I understand. Bondurus deserves that, and much more, for what he did to you. But you have to understand, we were incredibly lucky on this mission. There's no way that we should have been able to get away that easily."
"I know what I'm asking," Doc said. "And I know that some of you would like to walk away and go home now while we still can. I'm asking you to trust me in that the implications of letting this facility continue to exist are far more profound than any one crime boss's wallet. It's not likely I'll ever be in a position again to really do something about it either."
He gestured to the hissing DL-7 gunship as he finished. Once Doc stopped talking, Jason realized that they were all looking at him, waiting to see what his answer would be. He looked away from them for a moment and out over the alien landscape of the moon. The planet was rising up over the horizon to share the sky with the primary star, and the effect was simply breathtaking. After a moment's deliberation, Jason spoke again.
"You're asking too much," he insisted. "We were more or less forced into action in this instance. You're talking about a deliberate assault on a civilian target. I may not be up on all the ins and outs of legalities in this part of the galaxy, but I have to believe that what you're proposing is highly criminal.
Jason, you've personally killed nearly 10 beings since I've met you. You didn't seem overly concerned about legal complications then."
"That is not the way to get my cooperation," Jason shouted, jabbing a finger into Doc's chest for emphasis, suddenly irate. "A situation born out of self-defense is entirely different than premeditated killing. And make no mistake, firing on a building from a ship is no different than shooting someone with a gun. As I remember it, your hesitation almost got all of us killed. Where was your moral high ground after I killed that guard to save your life?"
The rest of the crew stood motionless, watching the increasingly hostile exchange between the two. Jason and Doc stared at each other for a few more tense seconds.
"You're right, Jason. I was out of line," Doc conceded, his shoulders slumping forward in defeat. "I'm sorry."
Jason drew in a breath to deliver another blistering retort, still seething, and then stopped himself. He slowly let his breath escape between his lips, his anger ebbing away with it.
"It's fine, Doc. I understand. I really do," Jason said softly.
"Guys," Twinko interjected once a lot of the heat had bled off the conversation, "why don't we talk about this later, once we've had some time to process everything we've just been through? I can see your side, Jason, and I'm inclined to agree with you. Attacking random targets will likely get us tossed down into a deep, dark hole for a long time. But there's no harm in hearing him out."
"We've come this far together," Jason said to everyone, but looking Doc in the eye. "If you're telling me this is something that needs to be done, then I guess we need to at least discuss it. Either way, it seems we're stuck with each other for at least the foreseeable future. I'm assuming we're all leaving on this ship together, right, guys?"
"I'm in,"
Twinko added instantly.
"Crusher?"
"I'm with Commander Burke for as long as he needs me."
"You guys have a spot for me?" Cage asked hopefully. "I don't really have anywhere else to go, and I like how this outfit operates."
Jason looked at the others and shrugged.
"Why not?" Jason said.
Looking up, he spotted 777 walking back towards their group.
"Hey, Lucky Seven, what can I do for you?"
"I apologize in advance for eavesdropping, Commander," he started. "But I would like to join your crew as well."
There is no place for me where the others are going, and I am certain I can be of use.
Glad to have you, Jason said, after seeing Crusher perk up at the notion of 777 joining their crew. He seemed to have a serious soft spot for the synth, for whatever reason.
What are we going to do with Dietz? Twingo asked, changing the subject.
Aw, shit. I completely forgot about that asshole, Jason swore. Come on, let's go deal with this now.
He marched back up the ramp without waiting for a response. Dietz was right where they'd left him, powered down and restrained in the heavy chair in engineering. The six-person crew stood in a semicircle around him.
So, what are we going to do with him? Doc asked, looking at Jason. Lucky, your kind is few and far between anymore, correct? Jason asked.
Yes, Commander. We are a species that is slowly going extinct. When the last of us goes offline, that will be the end of the synthetics, Lucky confirmed.
Jason weighed his options. Destroying Dietz was certainly the safest and most permanent course of action. But the thought that he might be contributing to a species extinction wasn't pleasant either. Staring at the still form in the chair, he knew what his decision had to be, so there was no point in dragging it out further than necessary.
We're not going to kill him, Jason said. Turn him on, Twingo.
Without a word, the engineer entered some commands on a tablet computer he had grabbed off a workbench. Dietz twitched and raised his head as he came back online.
Hello, Dietz. Nice nap.
Why have you done this, Jason? Dietz asked.
You've gotta be kidding me, you fucking weasel.
What was your deal with Bondress to turn me over? Jason was quickly losing both his patience and his temper.
Dietz flinched at the mention of the crime boss.
So, you found out. How clever of you.
This is true, then? Lucky asked. You were going to sell these men for personal gain?
What do you care? Dietz sneered. These are the same biologicals that would use you as a weapon with no concern for your safety or sanity, Combat Unit 777. You're nothing but an expendable resource.
Not to me, he isn't, Jason said forcefully, not interested in a protracted philosophical debate. And despite being a slimy piece of trash, neither are you. As I understand it, you're a fading species, and I won't contribute to that. Not today, at least. You're going to get on the ship that's sitting outside with all the other prisoners that we freed from the vault, and you're going to fly out of here, far, far away from me. This is a one-time reprieve. I catch you near me again, and I'll shut you down. Understood?
Yes. Dietz said, defeated.
Jason gestured for Twingo to release the clamps and allow Dietz to walk off the ship under his own power. He trudged out of engineering, not even considering trying anything foolish with the powerful battle synth right behind him. Once they reached the bottom of the ramp, Jason simply pointed to the waiting ship across the field.
Go, he said, before turning his back on the synth.
It was nearly 12 hours of back-breaking work later when the crew of the gunship watched the enormous cargo hauler lumber into the sky on an artificial gravity well and thrusters, both of which played hell with Jason's equilibrium. They stood watching until it was just a speck in the sky before heading back up the ramp. The cargo bay was now flush with crates and pallets loaded with precious metals, exotic weaponry, and hard currency sponsored by governments that still honored non-traceable bills. The crew shuffled up to the lounge area wearily, except for Lucky, who never tired, and sunk into the sofas.
So, do we talk this out now, or wait until tomorrow? Doc asked.
Fuck that. Anything we talk about now is likely to be meaningless. I'm wiped out, so I'm going to bed, Jason said as he got up. Computer, lock the ship up. Ground Defense Protocol Alpha.
Acknowledged.
I will stay on the bridge and monitor our defenses, Commander. I require no rest, Lucky offered, still standing while the others sat.
Look at you, Lucky Seven, earning your keep already, Jason said, patting the synth on the back as he walked by. Thanks. Let me know if you need anything. I'll be in my quarters. Good night, all.
Jason went to his quarters, kicked his boots off after laying his weapons on the desk, and, for the first time in weeks, fell into a deep, untroubled sleep. The rest of the crew dispersed slowly and found their way to their bunks. On the bridge, Combat Unit 777 stood like a sentinel, every sensor alert. As the rest of the crew slept, the battle synth stood watch and evaluated its existence, and, for the first time since coming online, felt some small sense of belonging. He hoped it wasn't fleeting.
Chapter 17. The battle synth descended from the bridge when he heard the crew stirring down in the galley. He approached the group and was waved over.
Good morning, Lucky, or whatever time it really is, Twingo called out to him.
Good morning, Twingo, Commander, crewmates, Lucky said respectfully as he moved to the end of the high-top table the crew was eating at. I trust everyone slept well?
Like a baby with you standing watch, Jason said between bites. First good sleep I've had since this debacle started.
We're going to discuss the possibility of our next operation after we eat, Doc said to the synth. We'd appreciate if you'd lend us whatever insight you might have.
It would be my pleasure, Lucky said.
20 minutes later, they were all crammed into the small meeting room on the upper deck, aft and port from the bridge, discussing their plan of attack on the facility Doc swore was a critical target.
Okay, Doc, now that we're all rested, fed, and calm, try to convince us we need to hit this target, Jason said as he sat down in one of the chairs.
Very well, Doc began, activating the main wall display. This is the planet Kalj 4, a standard-sized, lightly industrialized planet with a small population. It's mostly just large tracts of agricultural land that support the food demands of the heavily populated core planets.
Jason settled back as Doc continued to lead the briefing since he had detailed intel on the target. In fact, he had incredibly precise locations and schematics for the facility, thanks to a hidden, encrypted memory chip he had pulled out of the tablet computer he had brought on board with him at Pinnacle Station. So much so that it aroused Jason's suspicion about how involved he really was in Bondress's operations. After an hour of back and forth, the team decided that a direct approach would probably be best. The facility wasn't heavily fortified as it employed a hiding-in-plain-sight approach to secrecy. It was also not heavily staffed, another plus, since most of the crew wanted to avoid too much collateral damage and casual killing during the operation. The heavy arsenal the gunship carried made it possible for them to directly attack the target without too much risk. Doc was also adamant that they had to capture or kill a specific target he swore would be on site. He actually insisted that this objective was more important than the destruction of the complex itself. Crusher and Lucky immediately volunteered for this job, but Doc said the target would not put up much of a fight. She was an academic, not a warrior.
Her name is Dr. Javara Dechelik. Here's a picture of her, Doc was saying as he worked the controls for the room's main display.
The picture looked like a typical security badge mugshot and was of a female of the same species as the doctor. She had shoulder-length jet-black hair compared to Doc's bald head and looked to be quite a bit younger as well.
Why is she so dangerous, Doc? Jason asked.
She's really the linchpin to the whole operation. She's not necessarily the most brilliant scientist in the program, but she is the best at organizing the research across disciplines and keeping the project on track. Losing her will set them back years.
Doc looked at the picture wistfully for just a split second. It wasn't much, but it didn't escape Jason's notice.
And if this facility is left online, you're saying it poses a grave and immediate danger to a large number of people?
That's exactly what I'm saying. I can't overstate the risk in letting them continue this operation.
There isn't a world that wouldn't be left affected by what they're planning, including uninitiated planets like your own Earth.
Doc fell silent and stood at the head of the table, waiting.
Well, I'm not completely sold, but I'm not saying no either, Jason said carefully. Let's go ahead and start planning for a tactical strike on the facility, and we'll launch out shortly after. Once we're there, if it doesn't seem right, or even possible at all, I'm pulling the plug and we're bugging out.
I can't ask for more than that, Commander. Thank you, Doc said, with a slight nod.
Jason's real fear was that Doc wasn't overstating the case, and Earth would indeed be at risk by whatever was being cooked up in the genetics lab. It didn't lessen the risk of what they were being asked to do, but at least it was something tangible he could grasp onto if he actually did go through with the unprovoked attack on a civilian target. They adjourned the meeting, and Jason dismissed them to individually prepare for their role in the upcoming festivities. He had his own preparations to make, but first he followed Doc back to the infirmary to have a word with him while he was away from the others.
I know we've beat this to death, but you're 100% certain this needs to be done?
If it's such a risk, why not just alert the authorities?
Authorities? Doc snorted with disgust. You think I haven't tried that? I left an anonymous tip that led to an exhaustive investigation of the place. They found nothing that led to a single arrest or indictment, despite the very specific information I had provided. Bondras suspected I had notified the Confed Investigative Services and took it out on both me and my sister.
He shuddered involuntarily as he recalled that particular horror.
So what is this place exactly?
You have to give me something, Doc. You're asking us to risk a lot on faith.
The others are all trusting you to be on the level about this, Jason said, trying a different tack.
They're following you, Jason. Their decision has little to do with me. I wish I could answer your question in a way that would satisfy you, and I'm not being mysterious just for the sake of keeping secrets. But what you don't know, you can't be forced to divulge if the law or our enemies ever catches up with us.
Doc's answer left a cold lump in Jason's gut. Give me the broad strokes, then, he said.
It's a genetics research and production facility, the first of many planned. All I will say is that the work there could change the balance of power in this part of the galaxy in a profound way, Doc said, as he leaned back against the medical bed. Bondras is a facilitator in this instance. He's the front for other interested parties that can't actively be associated with this sort of work, as it's highly illegal.
You're talking about a conspiracy, and that usually means government, Jason said.
Very good, Commander. More than one in this case, or, more accurately, interested parties within certain governments. That's as much as I feel I should tell you, Jason. Again, I'm asking for this leap of faith from you with the purest of intentions.
While Jason was good at reading body language, his inexperience with Doc's species made it impossible for him to tell if he was being played.
So what's their ultimate goal? Jason asked.
The usual, Doc shrugged. Power and control. As happens from time to time, there are some that feel the great unwashed masses exist only to support the few elite. And once in a great while, these people are in an actionable position to try and make it a reality.
Well, Jason began slowly as he stood up, my decision hasn't changed. I'm willing to put it on the line again if this is really that serious, but I'm not sure I'm willing to ask the others to do the same.
He turned and walked towards the exit when Doc spoke up again.
It is that serious, Jason. I wouldn't have asked otherwise.
Jason simply nodded and walked back to the bridge.
If they were going to be rushing headlong into another fight, he had better get his shit together when it came to flying the ship.
Chapter 18. Much to Jason's relief and delight, the ship had a simulation mode that allowed him to get some real seat time at the helm.
It literally turned the gunship's bridge into a full-motion simulator with a level of fidelity simulator engineers on Earth could only dream about. The grav plating of the deck, the projection displays on the canopy, and all the controls and instruments were utilized by the computer to create an experience that was impossible to distinguish from actually flying. The beauty of it was that it allowed for all the bridge crew to participate in the same training scenario. His first instinct was to have Crusher fly in the co-pilot seat and operate the sensors and weapons, but the big warrior had almost no finesse and even less patience when it came to operating the ship's systems. He had also made it clear he had no interest in participating in the simulator training. With no genuine danger, he simply didn't see the point. So, with Crusher taking himself out of the running, Jason went a completely different direction and put Cage in the co-pilot seat. This ended up being a much better fit. The smaller alien was not only a natural at manipulating the controls, but his own set of unique neural implants allowed him to meld with the ship in a way that none of the others could. This solidified the crewing decisions Jason needed to make before they attempted their next mission. He, Cage, and Doc would be on the bridge, unless there was a medical emergency. Twingo would be in engineering, and Crusher and Lucky would be in full kit in the armory in case they needed boots on the ground. Even with Jason's ability to have information pumped into his brain via the neural implant, the training wasn't all smooth sailing. He struggled to pilot the ship as the unfamiliar information he had injected in his head clashed with his instincts developed from what he knew about flying airplanes on Earth. Twingo had been on the bridge trying to help him over the rough patch, but even his patience was wearing thin. After a particularly miserable effort in which Jason had, yet again, crashed the ship, the short alien rubbed his head and squinted at the ceiling in frustration.
"Maybe if you understood more about how the ship actually flew, it would help," he said.
"You think so?" Jason asked.
"It certainly couldn't hurt," Twingo muttered. "Okay, you keep trying to fly this as if it was an atmospheric aircraft with lift surfaces. You need to unlearn that. This ship moves by manipulating gravity. Let's start with the basics. What is gravity?"
"The force an object exerts on another in space," Jason said, feeling like a child being lectured.
"Incorrect. Gravity is the effect an object in space has on space itself. Think of space-time as a large bedsheet. Now, drop a large ball in the middle and a smaller ball near the edge, and what happens? The smaller ball rolls towards the larger, right? Why is that?"
Twingo seemed to be struggling to find analogies the human could relate to.
"The smaller ball rolls down the impression on the sheet left by the larger one," Jason said.
"Exactly. It isn't because the smaller ball is attracted to the larger ball as if it were magnetic. Now, that's how gravimetric engines of a starship work. They create localized gravity distortions that can be used to propel the ship. By changing the nature of the distortion, we can change the speed and altitude of the ship at will. It's like the ship is gliding down a perpetual slope, but we continually change the pitch and direction of the slope."
"Then why have such large main engines as well?" Jason asked.
"Grav drives are fantastic, but fickle. Their fields can be interrupted by gravimetric projectors, other drive fields, or natural occurrences in space. On something like that cargo hauler we stole, that isn't a huge deal, but on a ship like this, being left powerless isn't an option. So Jepson also fitted her with some of the biggest thrusting motors I've ever seen."
Twingo had moved over to lean against the console during his impromptu class. After having a bit more depth of knowledge in the ship's operations, the rest of Jason's training time seemed to be much more productive. He got to where he rarely killed them all during simulations and was starting to get the hang of transitioning the ship from void flying to flying in an atmosphere. Their last day on the moon, Jason ran them through a specially developed training sim that was as close as he could make to what they would actually face based on Doc's information. They ran through it three times with no major hang-ups and a successful outcome each session. Jason was especially pleased and somewhat surprised
at how well the crew was meshing. The personality differences seemed to complement each other rather than be a source of conflict, and each member went about his job without complaint. As they all sat in the galley that evening, Jason allowed himself a small sliver of hope that they would not only take out their target, but live to hoist a beer afterwards. After the evening meal, Jason went outside to inspect the hull with Twingo to see where the damage control bots had repaired the impact damage they had sustained fleeing the vault. As bad as it had initially looked, the damage proved to be mostly superficial and was easily erased by the small, automated repair crew. After that, they performed a full checkout on the ship's power plant, engines, and weaponry. Everything was full mission capable, so Jason saw no point in delaying. They lifted off from the moon's surface as the primary star was just setting on the horizon. Jason flew them on a lazy arc out of orbit towards the edge of the system before engaging the slip drive and sending them hurtling towards their objective. Once safely in slip space, he left Lucky on the bridge for the nightly watch and went to bed with the rest of the crew. The next couple of days would likely be long and arduous. Chapter 19. The gunship emerged into real space just outside the heliopause of the Kalch system, approximately 52 hours after they left the safety of the moon they'd been camped on. Jason waited for Cage to let him know if they'd damaged anything during the flight. He'd pushed the ship pretty hard to try and make up the time they'd lost sitting on the moon, effecting repairs and training.
"We're still FMC, Commander," Cage said evenly, "and you're clear to begin maneuvering."
FMC stood for Fully Mission Capable and was an acronym from Jason's time in the USAF that he used out of habit, that the rest of the crew had begun to pick up on and work into their own lexicon.
"Understood," Jason said. "Grav drive coming online and turning on course for the fourth planet."
They were following a commercial shipping lane in-system, so they weren't concerned about the gravity drive's signature being detected. Jason was keeping the reactor power down low enough that it wouldn't raise the suspicion of anyone who happened to be looking.
"We're less than 2 hours out, team," he said over the ship's PA. "Everyone stay loose."
The gunship slid through the system, unchallenged, before achieving a high parking orbit that would be common for a cargo vessel that was waiting on clearance to make landfall. They made three complete orbits around the planet, a green, lush-looking world with lots of surface water, mapping the ground with their sensors on each pass. Cage easily deflected inquiries by the planet's ground controllers by claiming they were a courier ship that was repairing a flaky drive before attempting a landing. Doc and Cage spotted the facility fairly quickly thanks to the intel they already had. Otherwise, it might have been impossible to find. It was a nondescript series of buildings that was on the outskirts of an industrial district outside one of the planet's smaller cities. But it also had employed a dampening field that hid its power signature from orbital sensors. Doc was able to penetrate the field by knowing the frequency and modulation of the ground emitters. The picture wasn't very clear, but it was enough for them to get target locks on specific areas of the compound.
"You still sure about everything down there, Doc?" Jason asked, standing over the doctor's shoulder and looking at the display.
He was acutely aware he was about to launch an unprovoked attack on a civilian target in a populated area without any warning or formal declaration of intent.
"It's exactly as I left it. I would have assumed once I disappeared they would have begun shutting this place down, or at least started moving everything. But I don't see any unusual activity down there," he said, looking back at Jason. "We're clear to engage, Commander."
"Okay," Jason said, walking back to his seat. "Begin feeding target coordinates to Cage, Doc."
He addressed the rest of the crew over the PA.
"It's almost showtime, boys. Everyone switch comms over to open channel and get ready to commence operations."
"Engineering checking in," said Twingo.
"Ground assault, ready to go,"
Crusher checked in for himself and Lucky. Jason took a couple of slow breaths to steady himself and tried to tamp down the adrenaline spike he felt as the ship crossed the Terminator and into daylight.
10 seconds, he told his crew.
He nodded to Cage, who armed the ship's offensive and defensive weapons. This was the point of no return. The power surge of their weapons coming online would easily be spotted by the ground control sensors. The lights on the bridge dimmed, and red light pipes glowed on the floor, illuminating the walkways.
TACCON Delta,
Cage reported, telling Jason that the gunship was now in tactical condition, Delta, meaning all weapons were powered and armed, and shields were at full power. Jason could see on his comm board that the planet's ground controllers were trying to hail them. He muted them and ignored the flashing alert. He tensed up and waited for the countdown on his center display to reach zero. When the countdown timer disappeared, Jason shoved the nose hard over and dove towards the planet. He crossed through a transfer orbit, narrowly missing an oversized, underpowered cargo hauler that was laboring out of the planet's well, and pushed on into the upper atmosphere. He leveled out within the mesosphere and banked onto a northerly course that would take them over the target, the waves of gravitational distortion from the engines clearly visible as the ship plowed through the upper layers of the atmosphere.
"Weapons release in two,"
Cage said, never looking up from his displays as his four hands deftly manipulated the ship's controls. 2 seconds later, a weapons bay opened in the ship's belly, and 6 missiles were spit out and sent on their way. Active telemetry began to come in from the missiles to Cage's terminal as they accelerated to hypersonic velocity and tracked for the target. Jason nudged the DL-7 into a pursuit course and followed the missiles down towards the surface, the ship shuddering slightly as it muscled through the increasingly heavy atmosphere.
"Status," Jason said.
"We're still clean. No surface launches. All missiles tracking,"
Cage said. It was 11 seconds later when the missiles slammed straight down into the ground all around the compound, kicking up 6 impressive plumes of dirt and rock. The missiles had been programmed to penetrate deep into the ground before the warheads detonated. Their targets were the extensive underground facilities Doc knew were there. 1 missile malfunctioned, and only 5 exploded. But the combined concussive force was sufficient to collapse large sections of the facility. The ground seemed to swallow up whole sections of the complex as if it were built over a sinkhole. The gunship screamed over the city, decelerating violently as it came within range of the now smoking compound. The damage from the missiles was impressive, but they were taking no chances. Cage brought the ship's powerful main guns to bear and let loose a salvo of high-energy plasma that vaporized whole sections of the compound in a frightening display of destructive power. What wasn't destroyed instantly was flattened as the shock wave of superheated air from the plasma blasts slammed into it. Cage fired the main guns 3 more times before they overflew the site, and Jason wrapped the big ship into a tight right-hand turn. The ship groaned in protest as vapor poured off the wings from the sudden compression of the humid air during the high-G maneuver. But the effect on the crew was nullified by the artificial gravity generated by the deck plating. He angled his turn up slightly to gain some altitude and give them a better perspective for their second strafing run. Although badly battered, the facility still had some teeth. 3 heavy particle beams lanced out from rooftop emplacements and impacted the ship's shields with spectacular results. Sparks exploded around the outside of the ship, and alarms sounded as the shields fought to dissipate the energy from the beams. Jason aborted their run and yanked the ship into a vertical climb and went to full power. Even as the ship thundered into the sky, Cage was already targeting the beam emitters for their next run. Jason kicked the ship into a left-handed hammerhead turn and put their nose back on the target.
"Target's acquired and locked,"
Cage said. Jason accelerated savagely into a descending bank that would allow him to put their guns on target before coming into range of the particle cannons. Cage let loose with a full salvo from all the forward-facing weapons, resulting in an explosion that ripped the remaining buildings off their foundations and sent a massive plume of flame and debris right into their flight path.
"Shit!" Jason exclaimed,
knowing it was too late to avoid it, even as the DL-7 plunged through the raining debris. Some of the impacts felt quite heavy as it shot out the other side and into the clear.
"We've got a ground car that escaped," Cage shouted. "Two occupants, heading southwest away from the city."
"That'll be her. We need to stop that car, Commander,"
Doc said, speaking for the first time since the attack commenced. Jason fought the controls as he yanked the nose up and tried to bring the ship back around to track the ground vehicle. He actually had to switch flight modes and put the ship into a hover in order to pursue the comparatively slow ground vehicle.
"Take the road out in front of the car," Jason told Cage.
A split second later, the ship spat out an energy bolt that took out three lanes of roadway the car was traveling on. It instantly angled right onto a side street and accelerated away. Jason clumsily turned to pursue, the gunship wallowing in the low-speed maneuvering at the hands of a novice pilot. He swore to himself as the car took another turn and headed for a more populated area.
"Disengage weapons. They're entering a populated area."
"We may need to risk it, Commander,"
Doc said from his station.
"You know I won't do that."
"Ground assault team, get ready."
Jason goosed the ship ahead of the speeding car and swung back around to face it head-on. No small feat considering the size of the ship and the proximity of the buildings. He continued to descend, intent on forcing the car into stopping, or risk running headlong into the mouth of the beast, so to speak. His gamble paid off as the car swerved at the last minute and ran up onto a pedestrian walkway, jumping the curb and crashing through a large ground-level window. Jason was thankful that this particular ground car utilized wheels instead of hovering on repulsors. It was completely out of commission.
"Crusher, you guys are up,"
Jason said, as Cage opened the belly hatch that allowed Crusher and Lucky to fall in a controlled descent to the ground within a containment field. He watched on his display in awe as the pair sprinted into the building at incredible speed, both armed to the teeth. He climbed up and away from the street and swung over the building to avoid the risk of damaging the ship with a careless impact.
"It looks like they've escaped, Commander," Crusher reported. "The vehicle is empty, and there's no sign of them."
Doc slammed a fist onto his console and swore at that.
"We're going to head to the roof of this building and see if we can run into them on the way up."
"Copy that, ground team. We'll move to..."
Jason was cut off as the ship dipped and yawed to port.
"We're taking fire," Cage said. "Looks like two law enforcement aircraft approaching to intercept us. Energy weapons only, shields holding."
"Damn it.
Ground team, we're going to move away and try to elude our new friends. Try and make your way to the southern edge of this city block and wait for my call."
Jason swung the ship around to the north and accelerated aggressively on a course that would force the intercepting aircraft to radically change direction to try and keep up.
"Acknowledged, Commander,"
Crusher said calmly as the gunship screamed over the city, terrifying the residents. Jason swung around wide over the city as he pushed the ship to supersonic speeds to shake off his pursuers, his course taking him out of the population center and over rolling agricultural fields. He dropped down closer to the ground to mask their sensor signature and banked into a large sweeping turn that covered miles of ground until he was pointing back to the southern edge of the city. The two pursuing ships were not fooled by the move. They were soon joined by two more aircraft and moved to cut them off. Jason calculated the odds and decided to take the risk, pushing their velocity up as high as he dared as he raced back to his two crewmates he had left behind.
"Get ready to open the hatch and grab them," he said to Cage.
"Already on it. It's going to be close, though,"
was the tense reply.
"I know. Can't be helped."
"We're in position, Commander," Crusher said over the open channel. "We're on the roof of the tallest building on the southern edge of the city block we inserted at."
Cage quickly used their comm signal to pinpoint their location and send a waypoint to Jason's display, allowing him to fly directly to them.
"Heads up, guys. We'll be coming in hot,"
Jason warned them. He came in as close as he dared before pulling the nose up and flaring, bleeding off speed,
and bringing the ship to a rough hover over the roof. Cage activated the containment field to pull them off the rooftop and into the ship as soon as Jason edged over into position.
"We've got them, securing hatch and bringing the ventral shields back up," Cage said.
Jason hammered down on the controls and the ship surged forward just as the first shots from their pursuers began bouncing off the aft shields. The ship streaked through the sky and overflew the original target, now a smoking crater, one last time.
"Take a sensor sweep of the target. We'll analyze it later," he said as he climbed up and out of the city.
As soon as they overflew the site, Jason didn't try to be creative in their escape. He pointed the nose of the gunship straight up and slammed the grav drive to full power. It was only as they transitioned from the thermosphere into the exosphere that Jason began to unclench his muscles. There was no sign of pursuit from the surface, and they hadn't detected any space-based defensive capability on the way in. For the moment, it appeared they were safe. Jason accepted the first waypoint from Cage's station and engaged the slip drive while they were still in system. Once the canopy darkened and the weapons were powered down, Jason could feel the tension in his neck and shoulders and the sweat that caused his shirt to cling to him. He looked around at his bridge crew.
"Well, that didn't go exactly as planned."
"No, it didn't," Doc agreed, obviously frustrated as the rest of the crew made their way onto the bridge, including Twingo. "I'd feel better knowing we got her, but taking out that facility is a huge blow to their operation."
"And also painted a huge target on our backs," Twingo said.
"I'd say that was a given after the vault," Jason began, but was interrupted by an alert on his comm panel.
A slipspace communication was coming through, and it was specifically coming through to the ship's transponder code. Whoever it was knew exactly what ship they were contacting. With a feeling of dread, Jason activated the link and sent it to the main canopy display. He instantly regretted it as Bondress's face appeared, larger than life, on the enormous display. The crime boss was enraged beyond description as his skin kept shifting colors and his eyes threatened to bulge from his head.
"You! Did you think you could steal from me and hide?"
Bondress was screaming with barely contained fury.
"You've sealed your fate. Where is Dietz?"
Jason looked at the others in confusion. Apparently, Bondress was behind on his intel.
"He's currently unavailable," Jason said blandly. "Would you like me to give him a message?"
Bondress screamed in wordless fury and lashed out at the display with his claws. While he was still spouting gibberish and baring his teeth, someone slipped him a tablet display with something written on it. The boss read it and paled instantly to a light green. He looked up at the camera with a look of shock and horror written on his face.
"What have you done? What have you done?"
Bondress screamed. He pointed at Doc.
"Do you understand what you've done?"
"Completely," Doc said unflappably, walking into the video frame.
"I'm going to make you regret this," Bondress hissed, focusing on him. "I'll keep you alive for decades so I can torture you slowly. I'll..."
Lines of video interference ran through the feed as Bondress and his aide seemed to sway on their feet.
"What was that?"
"Sir, we're under attack!"
The shout came from someone off-screen as Bondress's ship seemed to take several more heavy hits. The crime boss looked utterly confused.
"Why are they attacking me? Get in touch with the other syndicate members, now!"
"Maybe you didn't pay your membership dues?" Jason suggested in a helpful tone.
Bondress snapped his head back to the display, seeming to have forgotten he had been talking to him.
"Did you have something to do with this?"
"Well," Jason said as he scratched his head thoughtfully, "there may be some slight confusion as to who actually stole the cargo ship from the vault. We might have sort of made it look like your security personnel shot the guards and made off with all that loot.
Look, you seem really busy. Maybe you can call back when you're not so pressed for time. Before Bondras could reply, sparks and smoke began filling the bridge of his ship, and the link suddenly terminated.
Well, Twingo said with a broad smile, lacing his hands behind his head as he sprawled in one of the bridge seats. That takes care of that.
Hopefully, Jason said. Chapter 20 Jason and Twingo stood watching the last cargo hauler roll away from the hangar and back towards the flight line. It had taken them a few weeks to fence all the stolen cargo they had liberated from the vault in a manner which kept it all low profile enough so the other crime bosses wouldn't hear about it. The precious metal had been easy enough, and a lot of the weaponry they decided not to keep wasn't easily traced. But the piles of printed currency had been problematic. Laundering a mountain of bills that had ID chips embedded in them hadn't been easy, but they eventually found a money launderer who was willing to take on the risk. Looking back at the empty hangar they had used to stage all of their ill-gotten goods left Jason with a sense of finality. In a way, he was sorry to see this adventure come to an end. He had been beaten, threatened, terrified, sold, but somewhere along the line, he had rediscovered that spark within himself, that love of life he had lost. The thought of returning to his little cabin in the mountains to simply mark time alone was now incredibly unappealing. He looked up at the sky of Breaker's World and saw they were about to get rained on.
"We'd better hustle unless we want to swim back," he said, slapping Twingo on the shoulder and walking back towards the far end of the spaceport.
The pair walked in silence, both lost in thought as they pondered what would happen to them now that they were finished with what they had set out to do. When they finally reached the far end of the complex, Jason broke into a smile as he caught sight of the sleek gunship. Like any man who had been through an incredible adventure with a particular machine, Jason felt an almost emotional bond with the Jepson Arrow DL-7. It had kept them safe during their bungling rescue mission attempt, and then provided the means with which to exact some measure of revenge on Bondras. Or complete revenge, depending on whether one believed the crime boss was actually dead. Jason wasn't so sure. He didn't know where he would be going from there, but he knew he didn't want to leave it behind. The other four crew members were standing under the ship's tail section as Jason and Twingo approached, just in time for the sky to open up with fat, painful raindrops. They all retreated up the ramp and stood at the mouth of the cargo bay as the rain soaked the ground and began to run off the ship in rivulets. They stood in silence for a few moments until Cage, the most high-strung among them, couldn't take it anymore.
"So, what's next?"
"I've wondered the same thing myself," Crusher said quietly.
They lapsed back into an uncomfortable silence.
"Why don't we do this?"
Twingo said, looking around at them.
"This what?" Jason asked.
"This! There are a lot of folks out there who have slipped through the cracks or have nobody to turn to. So many that live in fear and are ignored by uncaring or corrupt governments. We have a modest fortune, a unique skill set, and one badass warship," the engineer said, impassioned. "We could make it our job to make sure someone stands up for these people."
When he finished, they all looked around at each other, hints of smiles tugging at the corners of mouths. They turned back to Jason, and he looked at each of them in turn, already knowing what his own choice was going to be.
"Well, I can't leave you lunatics to your own devices, that much is certain."
"I'm in," he said, to cheers and wide smiles.
"I'm happy you've decided to continue leading us, Captain," Crusher said, as he squeezed Jason's shoulder hard enough to make him grit his teeth.
Cage edged over to the cargo bay computer terminal and started flying through menus and commands. Doc walked over and grabbed five more bottles of a local ale they had been drinking while the others began to discuss the details of their new arrangement. The computer's voice halted their conversation. Crew manifest update confirmed. Captain Jason Burke, commanding officer. They all looked over at Cage, who just smiled.
Now it's official, he said,
accepting a bottle of beer from Doc as he rejoined the group.
You know, Twingo said, we really should name her.
He gestured around him at the ship. The others nodded their assent.
Captain? Doc asked. What do you think?
In truth, Jason had already been thinking about it for the last few days, afraid to say it out loud.
In my world's mythology, there's a creature, a bird, actually, that is reborn in fire. It rises up from its own ashes. In a very real way, it's the same with all of us, and even the ship herself. We've all burned away our previous lives and have been reborn new.
It's called the Phoenix, Jason said.
A powerful name, Crusher approved.
The others nodded as well.
Am I to be included in this new unit? Lucky asked suddenly, silent up to that point.
You've earned a spot here, if you want it, Jason said. But it's up to you. You're welcome to stay here as a crewmate and a friend for as long as you wish. And later, if you decide you want to leave, we'll drop you off anywhere you want with your cut from the ship's treasury. The same goes for all of you. This is a strictly voluntary force.
Thank you, Captain, Lucky said. I would indeed like to stay and serve with you. All of you.
Glad to have you, Jason said with a smile.
He resisted the urge to shake the synth's hand. He wasn't sure Lucky's grip wouldn't accidentally crush all the bones in his own hand.
So, what are we going to be called? It's a little clunky to introduce ourselves as the group of guys who help people and then break their things,
Cage said with a grin. They again deferred to Jason, watching him expectantly.
You guys don't want to vote on any of this stuff? He asked, jokingly.
While we're all friends, you're our commanding officer. Whatever this becomes will be molded by you and the choices you make, Doc said seriously.
Jason stared out at the heavy rain and took a long pull off his beer.
Everything has a beginning and an end, an alpha and an omega, he said as he stared out over the spaceport, voicing a line of thought that had been in his head since they had landed. By the time we have to get involved, it will be as a last resort for most, at the very end of hope for those that we'll encounter. Who we are should speak to that, both for the people we'll be helping and those we'll be helping them against.
Captain Burke paused and looked his crew over again.
This wasn't going to be an easy life they just signed up for, but it could be hugely rewarding if they had the dedication and mental toughness for it.
Gentlemen, we are now Omega Force.
Epilogue. Jason Burke shuffled out onto the back porch of his cabin and took in the view. It was late summer, and the sun was just setting over the Rocky Mountains, splashing the sky with muted oranges and pinks. Beautiful. Being back on Earth had a surreal feel after what he had been through. It was as if he was now a stranger on his own world, and he began to feel anxious to leave again. He had come back to get his personal belongings, but once he was back, he realized that he didn't really have anything he wanted to take with him. He had been hiding here for so long, just going through the motions of living. He'd not realized how empty his existence had become while wallowing in self-pity. He felt like he'd been given a second chance with Omega Force. He had the ability to make a real difference again, but this time on his own terms. The same drive to serve that made him enlist in the Air Force and then volunteer for Special Forces in basic training was pushing him again to embrace this new role. This time would be different, though. As captain of the Phoenix, he would decide whom and what he would fight for. He would no longer be grist for the mill, risking his life for causes that weren't his own and a government that didn't care. He sighed and turned to walk back inside, closing the door behind him. He had also come home to tie up any and all loose ends and was mildly depressed to find that he didn't really have all that many. The rest of the crew was doing the same, spread out among the stars, each closing out what remained of their former lives. They had flown to Pinnacle Station a couple weeks ago, and the others had taken commercial flights to where they needed to go. Since Earth obviously had no flights available to it, Jason flew the Phoenix home. He had no living family save for an aunt and uncle that lived in southern Oklahoma, but he hadn't spoken to them in years. The only thing he had in the world, at least this one, was a little bit of cash saved up from his active duty days, a beat-up truck that wasn't worth much, and the cabin his parents had left him long ago. He had written a letter to the only person left on the planet he cared about, and left instructions on how to get to the property the cabin was on, and how to go about legally claiming it. After debating on how much to say, he had settled on a simple, "Goodbye and good luck." He eyed the two military duffel bags that were sitting on the living room floor, the sum of his worldly possessions, and then checked his watch. The Phoenix was sitting in high orbit, waiting to hear from him. He hadn't wanted to risk it being discovered by leaving it grounded while he took care of his business. When it was dark enough, he'd access the ship via his neural implant and have it come and get him. He would be a few days early to Pinnacle by leaving that night, but he didn't have any reason to hang around on Earth. He heard the front door to the cabin open on squeaky hinges and, expecting the worst, spun around to face whatever was coming in. When he saw who it was, his heart began to hammer in his chest, almost painfully, but not from fear. Standing in the doorway, blonde hair framed by the fading light of day, was her. She stood there, as beautiful as ever, his one true regret.
"Hi, Jason," she said softly. "I got your letter."
"Maybe the guys will be waiting at Pinnacle Station for me instead."
This has been Omega Rising, written by Joshua Dalzell, narrated by Paul Heitch. Copyright 2013 and 2014 by Joshua Dalzell. Production copyright 2014 by Joshua Dalzell.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.